Good evening, comrades. This is Belling the Cat, Marx and Engels on the Practical Organization of Socialism. The title of this talk comes from the well-known fable, which, as I was pleased to learn something new while researching this, was not actually by Aesop, but was a medieval addition to the canon. As I'm sure you all know, the story goes that oppressed by the exploitation of the cat, the rats and mice resolved to hang a bell around its neck so as to never fear being surprised by its approach. Once this brilliant plan was resolved upon, though, no mouse nor rat could be found brave enough to do the deed of belling the cat. As such, the tale was used as propaganda on behalf of the status quo. So you're unhappy with how things are, but do you have any achievable way of making change? It asked. There is no alternative is a common rhetorical device in favour of existing society and its dominant groups. The roots of this talk, then, come from a television programme from 2012, This Is How Long I Can Hold a Grudge, Masters of Money by Stephanie Flanders, which had an episode on Uncle Charlie Marx. You can find it on YouTube. As might be expected, it featured the presenter being shown Stasi cells. This is what happens if you try and replace capitalism, was leadenly implied. But further, Flanders claimed, Marx said we couldn't describe what the next stage of human development would look like any more than a feudal serf could have described our lives today. To which you might say, fair enough. Except you might also think it was pretty telling. After all, nobody else has been able to describe a convincing alternative to capitalism either. This is flat out untrue. Certainly, Charlie refused to write recipes for the cookshops of the future, repudiating the utopian tradition of designing a detailed plan for an ideal world, like Fourier with his plans where the level of detail went down to dogs with canisters around their necks for carrying messages. I'll add, though I shouldn't have to, that Charlie most certainly did not invent communism. What he did was to methodologically look at the existing movement and how workers of the world would make communism themselves. Instead of a universal reformer bringing communism complete and designed to the table, he saw it coming from the free activity of humans in concrete circumstances. Alongside this methodological basis for not describing communism in detail, we might also, and this will be one of the few interpolations I hope to come into this talk, look to the notion that in his public life and time, sufficient numbers of people knew full well what communism was, what it meant in practical terms. It therefore wasn't necessary for him to spend time describing it. I'll come to some sort of basis for that supposition at the end. My time is short, and so I will try to concentrate on those parts of Charlie and Fred's writings that expressly make comments on the practical organisation of communism, but I can't cover everything. Hopefully, my overly long handout doc will cover more ground. At best, this talk is intended as a starting point for further reading and thinking. The place for me to start is obviously the manifesto. I want to focus on two parts here. First and most importantly, is there something that is not directly practical, in as much as it's not describing functional practices as would be directly experienced in everyday life, but is the guiding principle of those practices which need to be assessed against. It's not from each according to their ability to each according to their needs, important though that precept is, because I suggest that is in itself an extrapolation of, in place of the old bourgeois society with its classes and antagonisms, we shall have an association in which the free development of each is the condition for the free development of all. Any practical measures of communism need to be assessed whether they are achieving the goal of making that condition real. That obviously precludes gulags, slave labour of any sort, or the exploitation of any section of society. It's a very strong imperative. Note also a Marxian keyword, association. Of lesser importance is point 8 of the list of measures that will be pretty generally applicable. Obviously, as Charlie and Fred note in the 1872 preface, the measures in the original were outmoded by the growth of industry and changes in society, as they were directed pretty much to building up industrial society in Europe of partially developed capitalism. But I find establishment of industrial armies, especially for agriculture, an interesting point and relevant to this talk. There's little mention or explanation of the term industrial armies in Marxist literature, and it does sound worryingly like the regimentation of everyday life, even grounds for Trotsky's idea of the militarization of labour. A Google search produces a handful of results. One example, in no other country have the intermediate stations between the millionaire commanding whole industrial armies and the wage slaves living only from hand to mouth so gradually been swept away from the soil. That's from Charlie's letter to the Labour Parliament, describing Britain of his time. So we find this in the manifesto. Workers are privates of the industrial army. They are placed under the command of a perfect hierarchy of officers and sergeants. So industrial army sounds pretty much like a synonym for firms, businesses, etc. Note, though, that armies are plural, while the association is singular. There's the connotation of command and control in armies still. So we can take from this that Charlie and Fred envisioned most people to be a member of an industrial army. But would they be privates under command? Since the bourgeoisie are no longer around, who heads up the industrial armies? I think we can look further into this through what effectively was the 19th century version of a Twitter spat between Charlie and Mickey Bakunin. This is online as Marx's Conspectus on Bakunin's Statism and Anarchy, in which Charlie copied out sections of Mickey's book and rebutted them. I find this to be an instructive document, and I was slightly gratified to find Bertel Ollman using it as a source in his essay, Marx's Vision of Communism, a Reconstruction. I'll give a citation for it in the handout. Ollman focuses more on the vision than on the practicality, but it's a very useful essay. Now, there are two points. First, this exchange. Mickey, the Germans number around 40 million. Will, for example, all 40 million be members of the government? Charlie, certainly, exclamation mark, since the whole thing begins with the self-government of the commune. So everyone in the above-mentioned association will be members of its government involved in self-government. Further, we have this exchange. Mickey, this dilemma is simply solved in the Marxist theory. By people's government, they understand the government of the people by means of a small number of leaders chosen, elected, by the people. Charlie, assign, exclamation mark. This is democratic twaddle, political drivel. Election is a political form present in the smallest Russian commune and artel. The character of election does not depend on this name, but on the economic foundation, the economic situation of the voters, and as soon as the functions have ceased to be political ones, there exists one, no government function, two, the distribution of general functions becomes a business matter that gives no one domination, three, election has none of its present political character. Much of the rest of this to and fro deals with Charlie defending democratic organisation from claims of domination, even referencing workers' cooperatives. Clearly, this suggests to me that, in Marx's mind, as well as the association being democratic, the industrial armies will themselves be run democratically. Yes, we do not have a constitution nor an org chart for this association and these armies, but as Charlie notes above, the forms of these organisations are common to even some of the most basic and archaic human organisations. There is nothing special that needs describing. As he writes in Volume 1 of Capital, all combined labour on a large scale requires more or less a directing authority in order to secure the harmonious working of the individual activities and to perform the general functions that have their origin in the action of the combined organism, as distinguished from the action of its separate organs. A single violin player is his own conductor. An orchestra requires a separate one. And again in Volume 3, all labour in which many individuals cooperate necessarily requires a commanding will to coordinate and unify the process. The functions which apply not to partial operations, but to the total activities of the workshop, much as that of an orchestra conductor. This is a productive job which must be performed in every combined mode of production. The image of the conductor and orchestra is a useful one, and some writers have picked up on it. As Charlie notes, there is no need for the conductor to own the orchestra or to concern herself with any of the orchestra's functions. It is a technical role and one compatible with democracy. It is worth mentioning at this point the programme of the French Workers' Party that Charlie and Fred helped draft, and which Fred certainly considered to be an excellent, concise statement of their argument. It states as two of its political goals, abolition of standing armies and the general arming of the people, and the commune to be master of its administration and its police. So this suggests an abolition of centralised coercive force for the Communist Association. Further, we have the economic measures. Again, I won't go through all of them, but suffice to say, Charlie does not propose the instant nationalisation of sausages, but he does call for the exploitation of all state-owned workshops to be entrusted to the workers who work there. This seems to be consistent with the picture of industrial armies built up above. Workers controlled their own workplaces. The rest, particularly the economic measures in the programme, were drawn up from pre-existing demands of the French workers' movement and were not concerned here with the question of transition. except in as much as it touches on how communist society would be organised. Now, there are further scattered comments directly touching on the practical organisation of communism to be found in Charlie's works. I found most of these through the simple expedient of looking up communism in the index of the three volumes of Capital, something Flanders could have done if she had been bothered. Some of these passages do get anthologised, but often with erroneous text either side which distorts them. My aim here is to try and let them speak for themselves. Normally they take the form of brief asides in larger chapters describing some aspects of the capitalist mode of production. I have found the ones in Volume 2 to be the most useful for this talk, which is perhaps not surprising. When people ask about practical organisation, they usually really mean buying and selling and distribution. They aren't asking about the communist organisation of a chemical works. Often they will start talking about supply and demand as if that was some utterly insightful eternal explanation for all economics, rather than the ideological expression of commercial society, ideas that were invented by people, developed, promulgated, and end up as obvious as known to all. To turn then to the detail of how to run a communist association, Charlie writes, "There's a certain difference between the costs incidental to bookkeeping or the unproductive expenditure of labour time on the one hand and those of mere buying and selling time on the other. The latter only arises in the definite social form of the process of production from the fact that it is the process of production of commodities. Bookkeeping as the control and ideal synthesis of the process becomes the more necessary the more the process assumes a social scale and loses its purely individual character. It is therefore more necessary in capitalist production than in the scattered production of handicraft and peasant economy, more necessary in collective production than in capitalist production. But the costs of bookkeeping drop as production becomes concentrated and bookkeeping becomes social." So that's from Capital Volume 2, where Uncle Charlie was discussing how bookkeeping is an unproductive sunken cost to the capitalist. And there will be a great need for bookkeeping in communism. But the concentration of resources in the hands of the communist association may help offset the effort and cost of maintaining this accounting. As he notes in Volume 3, after the abolition of the capitalist mode of production, but still retaining social production, the determination of value continues to prevail in the sense that the regulation of labour time and the distribution of social labour among the various production groups, ultimately the bookkeeping encompassing all of this, becomes more essential than ever. That is complemented by this section from Volume 2. If we conceive of a society as being not capitalistic but communistic, there will be no money capital at all in the first place. Not the disguises cloaking the transactions arising on account of it. The question then comes down to the need of society to calculate beforehand how much labour, means of production and means of subsistence it can invest without detriment in such lines of business as, for instance, the building of railways, which do not furnish any means of production or subsistence, nor produce any useful effect for a long time, a year or more, while they extract labour, means of production and means of subsistence from the total annual production. Here we can include bookkeeping as one of the unproductive costs society will have to take into account. Now, there are two things to note here. First, the clear statement, there will be no money capital. The implication of that is that there will be no circuit of capital, that is, no need to turn over money and to return investment in goods back into the money form. Second, that society, and he doesn't mention a central planning office, will decide how to direct not just labour but resources as such, and without the distortion of money. Now, he doesn't specify whether he's talking about abstract or concrete labour here. That is he talking about aggregate labour of the aggregate total available hours, labour hours of society, or the specific types available? How many hours of doctor, electrician, or farmer are available? But we can leave that to one side, and that's something that's for us to debate and look at in our own time. And I will return to the word decide later. I think it's important. Charlie expands on this theme. On the basis of socialised production, the scale must be ascertained on which those operations, which withdraw labour power and means of production for a long time without supplying any product as a useful effect in the interim, can be carried on without injuring branches of production which not only withdraw labour power and means of production continually or several times a year, but also supply means of subsistence and of production. Under socialised as well as capitalist production, the labourers in branches of business with shorter working periods Well, as before, withdraw products only for a short time without giving any products in return, while branches of business with longer working periods continually withdraw products for a time, longer time before they return anything. The circumstance then arises from the material character of the particular processes, not from its social form. In the case of socialized production, the money capital is eliminated. Society distributes labor power and means of production to different branches of production. The producers may, for all it matters, note, receive paper vouchers entitling them to withdraw from the social supplies of consumer goods a quantity corresponding to their labor time. These vouchers are not money. They do not circulate. So here we have labor vouchers. The first thing to note is that he is not demanding these vouchers, but simply saying they could be used. This is in line with his practice of drawing from the workers' movement, what the workers' movement were doing already, and such vouchers had been suggested and used by the Owenites. Note also that this touches on the discussion of vouchers in the critique of the Gotha programme. The word corresponding to labour time is significant. As he noted there, there has to be deduction for unproductive labour for those unable to work. The vouchers each member of the industrial army received cannot represent the whole input of each individual worker. Importantly, and again, he emphasizes these vouchers are not money, they are not circulating, they are a part of the bookkeeping and association accounting for its own resources. As is noted in Volume 3, it is only where production is under the actual predetermining control of society that the latter establishes a relation between the volume of social labour time applied in producing definite articles and the volume of social wants to be satisfied by these articles. This leads us to an interesting passage which amounts to a bit of cold reading, but I think it's worth noting. And I've had to eliminate some of the meandering to make it uncomprehensible here. The full form will be in the handout. Once the capitalist form of production, reproduction is abolished, it is only a matter of the volume of expiring portion of fixed capital varying in successive years. If it is very large in a certain year, then it is certainly so much smaller the next year. The quantity of raw materials, semi-finished products, and auxiliary materials required for the annual production of articles of consumption does not decrease in consequence. Hence, the aggregate production of means of production would have to increase in the one case and decrease in the other. This can be remedied only by continuous relative overproduction. There must be, on the one hand, a certain quantity of fixed capital produced in excess of that which is directly required. On the one hand, and particularly, there must be a supply of raw materials, etc., in excess of the direct annual requirements. This applies especially to means of subsistence. This sort of overproduction is tantamount to control by society over the material means of its own production. But within capitalist society, it's an element of anarchy. I think this is an important passage. Essentially, we have to produce in excess of to the particular needs for any given good and keep supplies in store. I think this needs to be read in the light of the comment about money capital above. This sort of overproduction is only possible because the Communist Association would not be trying to turn its capital over and return it to money form. This is not that communism would be wasteful, but that the kind of efficiency required under modern business is about maximizing profit for the capitalist, not for the benefits of the community. As Charlie observes, the capitalist's fanatical insistence on economy in means of production is therefore quite understandable. That nothing is lost or wasted and means of production are consumed only in the manner required by production itself depends partly on the skill and intelligence of the labourers and partly on the discipline enforced by the capitalist for their combined labour. This discipline will become superfluous under a social system in which labourers work for their own account, as it has already become pretty superfluous in piecework. And as we saw during the early pandemic lockdown, just-in-time supply chains led to shortages and bottlenecks with a slight change in purchasing patterns. So we do need to have some sort of buffer in order to ensure regular supply. I have two other points to raise, both from Capital Volume 3. The quotes themselves I will leave to the handout, which itself will be far too wordy. But as Charlie notes, there will be no rent component. The association, if it owns the land, will not feel any need to charge itself rent. Joan Robinson, in her An Essay on Marxian Economics, attacks him on this point. Her understanding, though, rests on the idea that early stage communism, certainly, will entail exchanging goods at their full value as commodities, and thus abolishing rents would lead to distorted value denominations on differently productive land. I would argue, though, that Charlie is not discussing establishing production values, but is looking at real costs in terms of labour time used as an accounting tool. Notably, Robinson quotes many of the same passages I have used here, but I think she has misread them, missing the fact that some of the comments are citing longer passages dealing with commodities under capitalist production. This is further disguised by ellipsis linking the aside to later sections in the text. I would also like to note this short passage. Freedom in this field can only consist in socialised man, the associated producers rationally regulating their interchange with nature, bring it under their common control instead of being ruled by it, as by the blind forces of nature, and achieving this with the least expenditure of energy and under conditions most favourable to and worthy of their human nature. But it nonetheless still remains a realm of necessity. Beyond it begins the development of human energy, which is an end in itself, the true realm of freedom, which, however, can blossom forth only when this realm of necessity has its basis. The shortening of the working day is its basic prerequisite. As Charlie notes in Capital elsewhere, under the capitalist mode of production, some are left idle, not working, while a few are left to work harder, ever harder and harder. Technological innovation exacerbates this situation. The idea of shortening the amount of labour we all do is that it increases all our freedom. Instead of technological innovation increasing the intensity of work, the Communist Association will see to it that it lightens the burden on us all. To come to the end of my tour through Charlie's writings, I want to bring up this passage from Capital Volume 1, the only one he saw through to publication himself. It's quite long. Let us now picture to ourselves, by way of change, a community of free individuals carrying on their work with the means of production in common, in which the labour power of all the different individuals is consciously applied as the combined labour power of the community. All the characteristics of Robinson's, Crusoe, not Joan, labour are here repeated, but with this difference, that they are social instead of individual. Everything produced by him was exclusively the result of his own personal labour, and therefore simply an object of use for himself. The total product of our community is a social product. One portion serves as fresh means of production and remains social, but another portion is consumed by members as means of subsistence. A distribution of this portion among them is consequently necessary. The mode of this distribution will vary with the productive organisation of the community and the degree of historical development attained by the producers. We will assume, but merely for the sake of a parallel with production of commodities, that the share of each individual producer in the means of subsistence is determined by his labour time. Labour time would, in that case, play a double part. Its apportionment in accordance with a definite social plan maintains the proper proportion between the different kinds of work to be done and the various wants of the community. On the other hand, it also serves as a measure of the portion of common labour borne by each individual and of his share in the total product destined for individual consumption. The social relations of the individual producers with regard to their labour and to its products are in this case perfectly simple and intelligible, and with that regard not only to production but also to distribution. And this kind of serves at this point as a form of summation. This is possibly the most complete description of a communist association in Charlie's writings. Again, the sense is a little indefinite. It's an assumption to illustrate commodity circulation, but it does speak of a definite social plan. Labour serves as a measure and is apportioned in line with that plan. Okay, so now I want to turn to Big Freddy Engels. I left him to the back of this talk because, unlike Charlie, he produces texts much more directly discussing communism, and I want to look at them now. Now, the first text is Freddie's speeches at Elberfeld, where he was trying to persuade good German burghers that communism was a spiffing idea. For reasons of time, I'm not going to quote his lovely description of rationalising resources by everyone living in huge collective homes, except to note that despite protesting against utopianism, Freddie at least wasn't above a little bit of speculation. Now, and it does show a part of a practical bent about thinking how things owned in common could rationalise and improve living conditions. More to my theme is this passage. If you think about this, you will find that human society has an abundance of productive forces at its disposal, which only await a rational organisation, regulated distribution, in order to go into operation for the greatest benefit for all. After this, you will be able to judge how totally unfounded is the fear that, given a just distribution of social activity, individuals would bear such a load of labour as would make it impossible for them to engage in anything else. On the contrary, we can assume that given this kind of organisation, the present customary labour time of the individual will be reduced by half simply by making use of the labour which is either not used at all or used disadvantageously. The context here is that Freddie, noting the institution of communism, would see the abolition of many occupations of jobs created by the capitalist mode of production, such as servants and overseers, which would mean that people could be freed up to do more directly productive work, and unemployment as such could be abolished. As he notes, in communist society, it'll be easy to be informed about both production and consumption. Since we know how much on average a person needs, it is easy to calculate how much is needed by a given number of individuals, and since production is no longer in the hands of private producers but in those of the community and its administrative bodies, it is a trifling matter to regulate production according to needs. This might sound very optimistic, but as you shall see, he had some basis for this analysis. But here, information is the key, and information is knowing what the supply and demand are in advance rather than discovering through the marketplace. In the first instance, he gives an extended example of how to get a bale of cotton from the USA to Germany. Such a complicated way of transport is out of question in a rationally organised society. To keep our example, just as one can easily determine how much cotton or manufactured goods an individual colony needs, it'll be equally easy for the central authority to determine how much all the villages and townships in the country need. Once such statistics have been worked out, which can easily be done in a year or two, average annual consumption will only change in proportion to the increase in population. It is therefore easy at appropriate time to determine in advance what amount of each particular article the people will need. The entire great amount will be ordered direct from the source of supply. It'll then be possible to procure it directly without middlemen, without more delay, and unloading them is really required by the nature of the journey, that is, with a great saving of labour power. It will not be necessary to pay the speculators, the dealers large and small, their rake off. Indeed, he now notes the middlemen will be available for productive work. Now, this text does talk of a central authority, but in terms of seeing statistics and bookkeeping as the basis for organisation, it seems of a piece with Charlie's discussions. Note also the assumption of no economic growth separate from population growth. Now, if Freddie seems a bit hand-wavy with his "this will be easy" approach, it should be borne in mind that he wasn't just talking from abstract ideas, but with practical examples before his eye. In 1845, he published an article with the title "Description of Recently Founded Communist Colonies Still in Existence," in which he affirms, "Communism, social existence and activity based on community of goods, is not only possible, but has actually been realised in many communities in America and in one place in England, with the greatest success, and that all communist colonies so far have become enormously rich after 10 or 15 years, that they have everything they can desire in greater abundance than they consume." As an aside, it isn't my purpose here to assess the accuracy of these claims, merely that Fred made them, in as far as they pertain to the actual structure of practical communist society and his ideas on the same. He began with a description of the Shaker communities of America, noting their religious character is not essential to their communal organisation. Each of these communities is a fine, well-laid-out town with dwelling houses, factories, workshops, assembly buildings and barns. They have flower and vegetable gardens, fruit trees, vineyards, meadows and arable land in abundance. Then livestock of all kinds, horses and beef cattle, sheep, pigs and poultry, in excess of their needs and of the very best breeds. Their granaries are always full of corn, their storerooms full of clothing materials, so that an English traveller who visited them said he could not understand why these people still worked, when after all they possessed an abundance of everything, unless it was that they simply worked as a pastime, having nothing else to do. Amongst these people, no one is obliged to work against his will, and no one seeks work in vain. They have no poor houses and infirmaries, having not a single person poor and destitute, nor any abandoned widows and orphans. All their needs are met, and they need fear no want. Note again the emphasis on abundance. This also relates to his observation that In their 10 towns, there is not a single gendarme or police officer, no judge, lawyer or soldier, no prison or penitentiary, and yet there is proper order in all their affairs. The laws of the land are not for them, and as far as they are concerned, could just as well be abolished and no one would notice any difference, for they are the most peaceable citizens and have never yet yielded a single criminal for the prisons. The laws haven't been abolished, but the condition for their operation has been obviated. In terms of the practical organisation, he notes, they enjoy the most absolute community of goods and have no trade and no money among themselves. He notes a traveller describing their society. The Board of Trustee keeps all the books and accounts in a public office, and the books are open for all members to see as often as they choose. Each family has a separate domestic establishment and lives together in large, handsome mansions, and all get every article required and as much as they want from the common stores of society, without any payment. A deacon is appointed to each family, whose business is to see that all are provided with everything they want and to anticipate their wants as far as possible. Furthermore, the property of the society is vested in a board of trustees, which consists of three persons. Oversees the whole establishment, directs labour and carries on transactions with neighbours. They have no power to buy or sell any land without the consent of the society. There are, of course, also foremen and managers in each department of labour. However, they have made it a rule that no commands are ever given by anyone, but all are to be persuaded by kindness. I should add that the families of the Shakers were arbitrary divisions as their beliefs forbade marriage. He also discusses the Owenite colony of Harmony in Hampshire. The description is similar to the American colonies, but he notes, the members of the community were not the sole owners of the establishment, but were governed by the directors of the Society of Socialists, to whom the establishment belongs. Misunderstandings and dissatisfaction arose at intervals from this too. These directors are chosen annually by the Congress, to which every local society sends a member, and they have full, unrestricted powers within the statutes of the society and are responsible to the Congress. The community is thus governed by people who live outside it, and in these circumstances there cannot fail to be misunderstandings and irritations. But even if the experiment in Harmony were to fail in consequence of this and financial problems, which, however, is not the slightest degree in prospect, this will be only further argument for community of goods, as these two difficulties have their cause in the fact that community has not yet fully been realised. I think this is an instructive observation when it comes to Fred's notions of communism. The community of goods must be self-organised. Hence, in his speech at Elberfeld, he suggested that community of goods would come about in different ways in different countries, even proposing that colonies such as Harmony might be the way to communism in England, and that different routes might be applied in France and Germany. It would be a conscious and fundamentally democratic decision. Although these colonies came in for a serious kicking in the manifesto, the point remains that they did serve as focal examples for Fred's understanding of how communism could or would be run. I think I have sufficiently covered Charlie's and Fred's notions of the practical organisation of communism. In the time allowed, I have just a couple of further observations I'd like to make. I'd like to return to the word decide. In Charlie's example of communal society, it was free workers owning the means of production in common who would decide how to operate them. That is, given the restraints of practicality and reality, we are entering into the realm of freedom in which members of the association choose how it will be run and what it will look like. This is at the heart of his and Fred's opposition to utopianism and a universal reformer deciding down to the last nut and rivet how a future society would be run. One of Charlie's greatest intellectual achievements was to describe the notion of commodity fetishism, that in a society built around the capitalist mode of production, relations between people become relations between things. I would like to suggest that when people are asking for a plan for communism, assuming good faith, what they are actually doing is engaging in such fetishism, seeing the plan, the org chart, that they would expect to dominate their lives because that's how they experience their life, experience life now. They expect system diagrams and explanations of signals to be used, when in fact it will be human will and decision that will allocate resources, not profitability. In the communist association, it will be relations between people that determine how things are run, and that will be through democratic debate. To sum up, They saw Democratic Association following a greed plan carried out by equally democratic work units producing and distributing the goods for society. There would be no money, but tokens corresponding to labour input might be used. A permanent surplus of goods would be required, and this would require accurate records of goods and stocks as well as of demand. The need for labour would be reduced to increase free time for all. So, yes, Marx and Engels don't tell us exactly how to bell the cat, but they do point out that circumstances will force us to do so and that it will be possible to do so. None of this is to say that their ideas were right, the best, or that other ways of running a communist association might not be found. But it cannot be said that they had no idea how communism could work. Mice and rats of the world unite. You have nothing to lose but your chains. Thank you.